Well, thank you very much for the interview.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it. And how's the weather out there? You're getting those a lot of rain?
Oh, finally a day of sun. I swear, I thought if it rained another day, I'd have to move to California. Occidental was sounding perfect to me.
Yeah, it's obviously very timely speaking to you with 9/11 coming right up on us, and all the budgetary mess we're going through.
Interesting to have the confluence of the two at the same moment, to be remembering 9/11 and at the same time thinking so much about budgets and budget deficits and the debt, and especially the economy and the jobless rate in this country.
Well, exactly. And maybe we can go over your background. It looks like heavy into numbers, PhD in mathematics.
Right. I started out as a mathematician, and now a lot of the mathematics I do is, well, I add, I subtract, I multiply and divide, but not the high-powered work that I set out in life to do. But in a lot of ways, the policy relevance of what I'm doing makes me a lot happier.
That's a good point. What did you start out? What was your focus back when?
I was interested in stochastic processes, and in particular in stochastic differential equations, which have some really good applications. Some of the work that underlies the whole idea of derivatives in the stock market and the bond markets came initially from the area that I was doing research in. And some thinking about, things like making sure that rockets work.
Oh, yeah.
They come from that field, because to filter out noise, you have to think about things with stochastic processes and consider the stochastic differential equations that I worked on. But I got away from that without too much loss to my psyche as I shifted from looking at the sort of how military equipment works and how warfare works, shifted from that more to a focus on the money side of things.
Interesting. It's interesting how our life paths, where we think we're going and where we end up.
Right. Yeah, you can change over a lifetime, and I know I did.
Well, and I think that's more relevant today. I think it's going to be rare that somebody does the same thing their whole life anymore.
I think that's right. I think the economy has really changed in a way that it puts a lot of value on people who can be a little bit nimble and who are mentally willing as well as prepared in terms of skills and education to make big shifts in the type of work that they do over the course of their lives.
Right. And now, talking about 9/11, can I ask you where you were when it occurred?
Yes, I was on my way to work. My husband and I were driving to school, and the news came on, and I have to say, initially when we heard it, we both thought, this must be an exercise gone awry. We just couldn't take it into our brains that this was the genuine article, that this really was a terrorist attack by somebody who had commandeered four airplanes and started driving them into buildings.
Yeah. Who are you working for at that moment?
At the time, I was working at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where I still am a researcher. I'm on the research staff in a group called the Security Studies Program at MIT. And at that moment, I sensed that a lot was going to change for the nation, for the United States of America. And I was very worried about the way things would change. And in some ways, my worst fears have come true, and in others, they haven't. One of my biggest concerns was that in trying to deal with terrorist threats, Americans would give up something that's fundamentally American, the the fundamental values having to do with human rights and with personal freedoms. And I do think we've lost something there, and we've certainly lost something in terms of convenience and not thinking about what bad things could happen. Bad things could be just around the corner. So I, you know, looking back, I think I was right to think that. Another thing that I was pretty sure of was that defense budgets would rise, and of course they did.
Yeah, yeah. So after that happened for you, obviously being involved in that, how did that change for you? Where did your life head because of 9/11?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I grew up in this business that I'm in, this business of studying the U.S. military and other military and how wars happen, how military forces work. I grew up in the nuclear era, and I grew up in this business studying things related to the Cold War. Mm. And the Cold War, of course, ended by 1991 when the Soviet Union completely fell apart. But it was 2001, 9/11, when I said, boy, those days are really behind us, and we are no longer even in the post-Cold War period. We're in a different period.
Yes, a different
period. So for my work, it really, you know, made me stop and think, what are the interesting problems going to be in the future, and how can I get some traction on looking at them in a sort of a scholarly way that would maybe help policymakers in the future.
Mm-hmm. Because that must be difficult. It seems a lot of the complaints have been that the military hasn't changed to suit the present-day threats, that they're really still fighting the Cold War. Is that the way, or how have we moved on that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a lot of the equipment that the military services are still buying, the Army vehicles, the Marine Corps vehicles, the airplanes that the Air Force buys, and the ships that the Navy builds. A lot of them do still look a lot like what was used during the Cold War, and some of them are still being built to the designs that were being readied in the Cold War. So it's easy to complain that the services haven't really given up their Cold War mentalities. But then you look at other things, the so-called MRAP, the mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle that's being purchased now for the Army and the Marine Corps to use in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a far cry from the sort of Humvees that it was meant to replace. So you see big differences like that. The Navy has started building shallow water ships because they're very concerned about getting up close to shore with smaller ships that are more versatile than some of the really big ships they have and have purchased in the past. So you see it in each service that they actually are making some changes in the kinds of things they asked to buy and that they purchased. The Air Force, it had barely started working with drones when the Cold War ended, and even as after 9/11, there weren't very many of the drones, and now that's become a favored tool. So there are differences. And I have to say, it's one of the things that I haven't been completely enamored of in since the Cold War ended and the U.S. military looked for various ways to reshape itself. One of the things that it hit upon quite early was that during the Gulf War of 1991, after Kuwait was invaded by Iraq and the U.S. fought, you know, put together a major coalition to fight a war against Iraq and push them back out of Kuwait. Mm-hmm. During that war, the U.S. for the first time unveiled the massive numbers of precision-guided munitions and relied to a large extent on electronics to help them choose targets and hit targets. And that really caused the services, to the U.S. military services, to say to themselves, we should do way more of that. And it is a much more technical way of fighting wars, and one that's more effective in a lot of ways, but it also gives you that sense of dissociation, that sense that you are in a video game, and right. While for the other side, it's not at all a video game. It's the death and destruction, as you say, the mayhem.
I suppose part of that shift, obviously, was going from a draft military to all volunteer.
I think that's a really good point. Now, the U.S. shifted to an all-volunteer force in 1973, just as the Vietnam War was winding down. And we did it for political reasons, and also for reasons that had to do with military effectiveness. And the sort of theory behind a shift to an all-volunteer force is that if a smaller military is all one needs. If you don't need to call up every single young man, or in today's case, young woman, to serve the country, then you can really do a lot by substituting capital for labor and shift to a smaller force that's more high-tech. And that's exactly what we did in 1973. Now, it took about a decade to kind of get a handle on it until the U.S. services were able to bring in the people who really could make this a reality, who could manage and contribute properly in this kind of more high-tech military. But over time, that happened, and so by 1983, 1984, the U.S. military, from a personnel point of view, was ready for that kind of warfare.
Hmm. One of the things that seems to have occurred over the last 10 years since 9/11 is the usage and growth of private contractors. That seems to be a big issue, fighting side by side with the military. There seems to be inequities. They seem to earn a lot more money. How does that fit into that package?
Yes, the shift to having far more contractors on the battlefield has been phenomenal, just extraordinary. If you had told me 10 years ago this is what we were headed for, I would never have believed you. Mm. But today in Iraq and Afghanistan, there is many contractors on the U.S. side as there are soldiers and Marines. So the number of troops in uniform is just about exactly equal to the number of contractors on the battlefield. But before we get too carried away in imagining that all of those contractors are carrying rifles, actually only a relatively small percentage of them are carrying rifles and as you say, fighting side by side. In fact, typically the ones who are carrying rifles might be protecting the embassy or doing some other security job related to the State Department or the other departments of federal government that are in Iraq right now. The more common thing that the contractors doing it is delivering services to the soldiers and then Marines, and so vast numbers of them are doing the laundry, or they are cooking the food, or they are doing the transportation. So that's really where you see this big buildup, and those people, by and large, the individuals carrying out that work are being paid very, very, very minimal wages. Hmm. Most of the money is going to the contractors who pull those people together to do the work and get them trained up and get them out to the points where they need to do it or onto the bases where they're going to do the laundry or do the cooking. And in fact, the majority of those contractors, the individuals who are working as contractors, are not U.S. citizens and they're not Iraqi citizens. They're third country nationals who have been brought in by the U.S. contractors to do this work for the soldiers.
And is this companies like Halliburton are the contractors here?
Yes, Halliburton is one of the, in fact, probably the biggest, Kellogg Brown and Root, the piece of Halliburton that does this kind of work is probably the biggest of them, although there are probably others at this point that are growing in size, but they are main deliverers of these sort of logistic services and food operations and laundry operations.
What we're seeing here, really, in terms of the privatization of government, is really reflected out there in our wars as well.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. Yeah, I mean, here there's been a big push in this country toward shifting work from the government over to the private sector. And in a lot of cases, that makes a lot of sense, because if you put things to the test for work that's relatively routine and where there's a thriving civilian marketplace of contractors that do that kind of work, typically it does save money for the government to do that, and it often increases quality, and it can even spark innovation to handle things that way. So when I look at things like, well, on a military base, for example, people have to paint the buildings. Should that be done by soldiers in uniform, or should that be done by a contractor? It's pretty clear to me that it should be done by a contractor, because there's a thriving marketplace for painters outside the gates of the base, and all you have to do is choose one. They'll all compete amongst themselves to get the work, and you'll get a lower price and a better quality of the work. The place that starts to fall apart is if work is inherently governmental. So there are things that you wouldn't want to ask a civilian to do on your behalf. And one of them, for me, I'm afraid to say, is your intelligence work. It strikes me that we're just much better off having government workers do that kind of work. But we have, I would say, the services have experimented with outsourcing quite a wide range of work, including the carrying of weapons and the looking like soldiers.
It's almost like how manufacturing has gone to China and other countries. We've actually really done the same thing in the military then. We've outsourced through American companies, but we've outsourced that actual work itself.
Right. The work that's done in the U.S., a lot of it has been outsourced to companies. So it used to be that standard bookkeeping would all be done by government civilians. You know, bookkeeping done in a government office would be done by government civilians. Today it's more and more likely that work, unless it involves, you know, something that the government really needs to hold close, could be done by a contractor. And there was a move to shift a lot of that. Now, that would be, of course, to a U.S. contractor, to a contractor in country. But then you do have this kind of outsourcing to foreign workers by the U.S. contractors who are providing services to the soldiers and Marines overseas.
Now, you've studied European military system. Where have they gone with their military compared to ours?
Well, the thing that's so interesting that's been going on in European militaries over the past decade and a half is that they've started to undertake these shifts away from a draft system, away from conscription or compulsory service, toward an all-volunteer force of the type that the United States has had since 1973. Mm. It started in 1994. First of all, let me say, the UK has had an all-volunteer force since the mid-1960s. They were really the first. And Canada, not European, but an important U.S. partner in NATO, Canada has had an all-volunteer force almost throughout its history, with exceptions for the big wars. But most continental European countries, up until the mid-1990s, retained conscription. And starting in 1994, I think Belgium was the first to shift, and then the Netherlands was the second. And this year, Germany shifted, which was just a major event in my mind, because Germany seemed as though, for societal reasons as well as military reasons, they would be the last to drop conscription. But now we're down to a situation where there are only five countries left in NATO that have conscription, and all the rest of NATO's 26 member states have an all-volunteer force.
Oh, interesting. And have they gone the way of private contractors like we have here?
No, you don't see that as much. I think there's some of it in the UK, and particularly as relates to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, probably just following suit with what the United States is doing. But generally, those militaries have not shifted to the large contractor base in the same way that the United States has.
Mm. I was just looking here that in the 10 years since 9/11, we've spent $7.2 trillion on defense. Now, I don't know if it's possible for you to guess, but say 9/11 hadn't happened and things had gone on, you know, pretty much as they had, with, you know, minor wars and things, how much do you think we would have spent in comparison, just to give a feel of the difference?
Yeah, I calculate that, first of all, if 9/11 hadn't happened, I am pretty sure we wouldn't have had the war in Afghanistan, and I don't think the Bush administration would have found the political climate favorable to having a war against Iraq. Mm-hmm. And so I would, first of all, say the cost of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, you would discount, you would get rid of them, mm-hmm. right? So there's $1.3 trillion right now of the $7 trillion that you mentioned, mm-hmm. $1.3 trillion. There's another $1 trillion that's sort of money over and above what we would have spent if in what's called the base budget, the regular, not war budget, mm-hmm. Of the Department of Defense. Another $1 trillion, I calculate. So probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $2.3 trillion that we wouldn't have spent. Now, if one way to think about that is, if you look at the debt crisis that people talk about, right, the concern over the mounting,
yeah.
the size of the mounting debt, that debt, the debt held by the public right now, comes to around $10 trillion. So you're talking about something like 25% of that debt being due to excess spending for the Department of Defense and other defense structures, and the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm. Whoa, that's interesting. That's a lot of dough.
It's something to think about. You know, when I started in this business, nobody ever used the term trillion. It just wasn't a word that came to mind. We always talked about billions, or, you know, hundreds of billions sounded so scary, and now we just throw around the word trillion like it was nothing.
Oh, dear. I think you're right. Yeah, you hear it way too often now, yeah. You've worked in the Pentagon. Could you give us some idea of the flavor of being in there, the mindset, and how it's like working with there, how open you can be in discussions with things?
I tell you, when I worked there, first of all, it was years ago, but I felt on top of the world. I loved my job because I was in a group that at the time was called Program Analysis and Evaluation in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And our job was to come to the Secretary of Defense with alternatives, options, other choices besides what the services were planning to do at the time. And so, and I worked on nuclear forces. So if the Air Force was planning to build a lot of bombers but not to have any weaponry for it, I would say, you know, it's not that good of an idea to bring the beer and not bring the popcorn. And the Secretary of Defense listened to us. The Secretary of Defense valued our analyses and wanted to know if the services were about to make a big boo-boo. And that just was really fun to me. Now, the other thing I did was keep track of what we were spending for nuclear forces, and that gave me a taste for the kind of work I do now of trying to just sort out, you know, is this a lot of the defense budget or a little? Is the public paying a huge amount for nuclear weapons, or is it really relatively small in the bigger scheme of things? So I found that just really intellectually interesting. Hmm.
Obviously, you know, when we're talking about budgets and things, you know, you're talking about, you know, real people doing real things and getting injured. How does that relate to those equations? How, you know, say, if we're planning for, say, a war, is that budget somehow budgeted in or reflected? How's that done?
Well, the question about we've had a lot of deaths on the U.S. side in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, 4,500 dead in Iraq, something like 1,750 dead in Afghanistan. Those deaths, people try to imagine beforehand how many deaths there might be, right, before a war started. But, of course, when President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld started this war in Iraq in 2003, they imagined that it would be over in 6 months and no Americans would lose their lives. Mm. So there's, you know, there can be extraordinary miscalculations on how long a war will take, on how achievable the aims are, on what the aims are in the first place, on how much money will be spent and how many people will die on either side. And I would have to say those miscalculations often are the reason why countries are able to whip up the fervor to go to war that's needed to get, you know, to get a population past the point of resisting war, because nobody ever wants one in the first instance.
Right.
But those miscalculations can be huge, and they can be very, very consequential.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I suppose with their thinking that it was going to be fairly short, was that why they really kept it out of the normal budget, the cost for the war? How did they see that?
It's the norm in the U.S. budgeting to not pay for wars up front, to not fold them into the defense budget in the first instance. And so what typically happens when a war starts is that the administration at that time starts putting together what's called an emergency supplemental request, an emergency supplemental appropriation request, for the Congress, and then the Congress typically looks at it, and with only a relatively small amount of oversight, passes the request. Now, it may take some time, but during the course of the year, typically Congress passes it. And that's not something that the administration insists on. In the past, it's always been something that Congress has been insisted on, because Congress wants to hold on to the purse strings. Mm-hmm. The last thing they want is to tell the president, and by the way, in case you might start a war this year, here's $100 billion just in case. That's the last thing they would ever want to do. They want the president to have to come to them for emergency money to conduct a war. The thing that was unique in this war was it's so far gone on for 10 years in the case of Afghanistan. 10 years is a long time to be on emergency supplemental appropriations. And in all previous U.S. wars. Ultimately, if it looked like the war had sort of become a steady state way of life, the war spending was then folded into the regular budget. And finally, in 2009, I think, just after Obama took office, President Obama had promised, as a campaign promise, that we would regularize this war spending in that way. And so now the war spending is presented to Congress with the rest of the budget, but in a separate, basically in a, it looks like an appendix to the budget, in a separate title to the budget, so that Congress members can still see what's spent on the war versus what's spent for the base budget, non-war costs, and yet has an idea from the beginning of the year, and as they're doing their careful scrutinizing work on the budgets, they can see what's going on in that war budget.
Mm. Going back to the Second World War, it was a different situation where, you know, America loaned a lot of money to the other countries who they were fighting with, and actually, you know, they had to pay the money back. I always remember in the 60s on the TV, every month they would say, oh, we've got so much debt left to America from the Second World War type of thing. It's changed, it seems.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. And, well, even if you look back at this was sort of the opposite, but the Gulf War of 1991, the United States got a lot of money from Japan and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia for the conduct of that war, so that ultimately the costs were paid by other countries for that war.
Mm. Because we were keeping the oil flow open for them, I suppose.
That's right. And also in Japan's case, you know, Japan has been very, very reluctant to have a military resurgence of any kind, and constitutionally their military is prevented from being an offensive military. In fact, it's always been called the Japan Defense Forces, not the Japanese military. And Japan was extremely reluctant to send forces of any kind to the Persian Gulf War of 1991, but instead agreed to send cash, basically.
Okay. Now, of course, we talked about military and public, and obviously the politicians are there in the middle, and you've actually had to go there and sit in front of them, and you know, we've all seen that on TV, how they ask questions. How is that, working with the politicians?
Oh, I have to say, I absolutely loved working for the Congress. I worked for 3 years as the head of the National Security Division of the Congressional Budget Office, and for me it was just the perfect job, because it's not in the terrible fray of being on a congressional staff, either of a committee or of a Congress member, but you're working on behalf of the members of Congress, the senators, and it was just an amazing opportunity for me to be able to testify before them as a witness for the Congressional Budget Office. I really loved that, because the opinions of the Congress members and the concerns that they have, because each one is coming from a different district, each one is coming from a different state, so the concerns of their constituents are quite varied, and their own thinking and concerns about defense, my subject, are extremely nuanced and varied. And so I found it a real pleasure, especially because I had started my career on the Pentagon side working for the executive branch. It was just really wonderful to have an opportunity to speak directly to the congressmen and senators.
Mm. Yeah, because it's interesting, the whole allocation of resources, you know, obviously a politician will want, you know, airplanes to be built in his place. How do you see that, you know, how is that to and fro in terms of the pork barrel type of images we see sometimes?
it's a huge influencer in how things work. And, you know, sometimes the services don't even think of the Congress as being an important influence in what they're going to buy, for example, or how big they can be. Mm-hmm. But in the end, the Congress holds the purse strings. That's what the Constitution says.
Yeah.
It's how it's meant to be. And congressmen have a lot to say about what, you know, where bases will be, what the size of the military will be, and what the spending will be for the military, and down to the line item inside the defense budget. So, and a lot of it is pork, and a lot of it is a kind of hidden pork that's built into the system because the service knows what the congressman wants before he even knows it. and so it doesn't have to look like something that was slapped on at the end by an earmark from a congressman. It can get into the military budget in other ways. That said, that's what our representative democracy is meant to produce, right? So I'm not somebody who screams, "Oh my God, there's so much pork in here," because one person's pork is another person's vital national security interest.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, we've had 10 years of these two wars and many other insurgencies and slopping over into Pakistan and other countries. Really, what do we have to show for it? Do you feel it's been effective? What is your take on it?
I think that in some ways it's been effective, but it's been way more costly than the effect that we've gotten. And so I would have been very happy to have skipped the war in Iraq entirely. That would have saved about $800 billion and 4,500 American lives and countless, you know, more than 100,000 Iraqi civilian lives.
Yeah.
Reading of the situation is that the Iraq war, no matter what anybody says, had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11 or with Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
I think it was important to strike in Afghanistan because I don't think it's right for the United States. I don't think it would have been right for the United States to let that sit and have the whole world know that terrorists, especially an organization like Al-Qaeda, could take sanctuary in Afghanistan, basically run the government there or be so deeply entwined with the government there that they might as well be running it, and strike the United States from a position of sanctuary and not be struck back. So I was totally in favor of starting that war. I'm not pleased to see that we're still there 10 years later. I think that war could have been handled more expediently if the United States hadn't gotten diverted on Iraq. Now, if I fast forward and look at the way that Al-Qaeda seems to have suffered, and certainly the killing of Osama bin Laden, I think the U.S. actually made a lot of progress there over the past 10 years, and that's a good thing. But that we didn't need either the Iraq war or the extended Afghanistan war to get us to that place. But I do think the Iraq war and the long nature of the Afghanistan war have made a lot of new enemies for the United States. You know, public sentiment in the Arab and Muslim world have simply plummeted since it had a boost after 9/11 because people actually did feel for the United States, but it plummeted after the Iraq war started. And so I think in some ways we're making enemies faster than we're getting rid of them, and that's not a good thing.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I was in Egypt just before the Iraq invasion and, talking to Egyptians, you know, they love Carter, they loved Clinton, you know, when you say George, it was like, you know, a total hatred came down on them. It was very interesting.
Right, and it's not good for any of us if there's hatred toward our executive branch, toward our administration or our Congress. It's not good for anybody in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. It's terrible when people have to say you're Canadian instead of American when you're going abroad. Obviously, a big thing that happened is, apart from all the overseas wars, was the establishment of the TSA and the whole security system we've created in America, which really doesn't... Those numbers aren't really included in those trillions of dollars in defense. Is that something separate?
That's something separate. Right now, the United States is spending about $70 billion on Homeland Security, and that contrasts with maybe $20 billion that we were spending on Homeland Security before before 9/11. So, you know, Homeland Security spending, even after you adjust for inflation, has tripled. That's really big in terms of, you know, in relative terms, but when you compare it to the size of the defense budget, it's still only about a tenth. So we're spending about $72 billion on Homeland Security, where it's spending about $700 billion on defense. So we're still not spending anything like the amount on, you could say, on defense as we're spending on offense, on Homeland Security as we're spending on the military. That said, there's still things that we're not doing in the Homeland Security arena that I think would put us in a better situation, not just for protecting ourselves in the event of another terrorist attack, but also in a much better situation for other emergencies, including things like flus that spread fast throughout the world. And that's beefing up our public health system. We've done some work on that through the Homeland Security budgets, but in my mind, not nearly enough.
We've got the system going. Why not spend some on things that could actually be very useful to our population?
Right, that it would be useful. Now, I have to say another thing I wish would happen in this country, but I don't see any signs of it politically, is that we could all become more resilient, not to just say, come on, terrorists, but to understand that sometimes attacks are going to happen. That's the world we live in. And that we'd be in a better position to get our minds right about that and not fly apart when it happens, not get ready to give up every civil liberty, give up every personal freedom and every sort of way of living that Americans take for granted because there's another terrorist attack. Because I do think ultimately there will be one. And the more we get our minds around that notion and have preparedness measures in place and try to help each other through it when it does happen, rather than sort of flying apart, the better off we're going to be. That kind of resilience I'd like to see. And I know now Janet Napolitano, the Secretary of Homeland Security, she talks about that. And I think it's really important for all Americans to try to embrace.
I suppose because there was, you know, no previous, I mean, more minor attacks and things on American soil, the history wasn't there. The reactive part of that, you know, is to go further the other way, I suppose, not understand.
Yes, I think it was just such a shock. But now we know these things can happen, and I'm not saying that I would welcome them. I certainly wouldn't, right? Yeah. And I don't want to give that impression whatsoever. Yeah. But I do think that we need to understand that they might happen, and that we have to have a thought in our minds about how we'll react as Americans.
So how do you see, well, say the next 5 years playing out with the way, you know, Congress is right now? Things seem pretty cloudy as to a more positive approach. How do you see that?
Well, I see us coming toward a train wreck, and there's two things that I think are going to collide. One is the there is an intention on both sides of the political aisle to reduce deficits and to start bringing the debt down, or at least not let the public debt rise further than it has already. And I think once we get through this terrible time of joblessness, that'll be a good thing to do. We do need to change the way that we structure our federal government intake and outflows, so that either we're paying more taxes or we're cutting back somewhere, so that we come closer to balancing the budget than we currently do, and that we are able to do that despite the influx of people my age as we approach our retirements and start dipping into Social Security and Medicare. So I think, you know, there's a big interest in reducing deficits by cutting $400 billion a year from federal government spending, or adding to taxes, doing something, and all of that is going to hit the Department of Defense. There is absolutely no way that the Department of Defense is not going to be cut. It is going to be cut, and my guess is by the end of the day, it's going to be cut relatively sharply. Mm. The problem we have is that as Americans, we haven't come to terms with what we want from a military that is therefore going to be smaller, because we can't continue to ask our military to conduct 10-year wars in places like Iraq and Afghanistan as we reduce the size of military budgets. We have to decide that we're going to have a different strategy for getting along with people in the world and for using our military in the future. And I don't see Americans, well, I see a lot of interest in cutting budgets, and I see people saying, and let's cut defense. I'm not seeing them sort of catch up on the other side of saying, and let's change our national security strategy to go along with the change that's going to result in our national security posture.
Hmm, interesting. Now, is that reflected in how the military relate to the politicians in terms of what they need? Are they, you know, pushing them to say, well, we, you know, all these threats, we really need this? How is that?
I think for people in uniform, it's actually very hard to trust the policymakers who might say, and we promise no more wars, right? And they go, what do you mean no more wars? You know, you're the one who got us into the last war, and we, you know, we're the last people to ask for a war.
Right.
So, you know, come back to us 50 years from now and tell us if you got us into a war or not. So it's hard for the military to accept it, but I think as a country, we just have to find a different way. And it goes back to this question about creating more terrorists. As long as the United States continues to sort of push other countries around and be in people's face in parts of the world where there's this kind of resistance, we are going to be creating energy that's going to backfire us on us and is going to draw us into wars. Mm. Now, there are other wars that are more wars of choice, where maybe we feel sorry for one side or the other in a civil war, we're concerned. I think we have to agree that we're not going to do as much of that either, that unless it's genuinely a vital and close to home U.S. interest, we are not going to start new wars. And once we've decided that, we can get by with a military that's probably 25% smaller than the one we have today, and we could save 25% from military spending. And over the next 5 years, I'd really like to see that conversation unfold in the United States and get resolved.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I know during the recent credit debt limit fiasco, if it hadn't come to a conclusion, there were some automatic cuts that were going to affect the Defense Department. Now, are they ready for those type of drastic, draconian things at any given time?
they're fighting them, but there's only so much they can do. So right now they're sitting there, you know, the uniformed military is sitting there, fingers crossed, that the so-called super committee that was formed up, the 12 members who met for the first time yesterday, I think, or the day before yesterday, who will be crafting a bipartisan plan for reducing deficits by $1.2 trillion over the coming 10 years. The military is hoping that that super committee will give them a cut of maybe $30 billion or $40 billion a year instead of the automatic cuts that will kick in if that committee doesn't come to an agreement or doesn't come to an agreement that both chambers of Congress and the president can all agree to. Because if that happens, the military is facing cuts of something like $85 billion a year out of its base budget of about $550 billion a year.
Mm. That's a big chunk, yeah.
So a cut of around 15%.
And, oh, one thing I noticed, you're on the Advisory Committee of Women in International Security. Now, obviously, the military has been such male-dominated over the years. How is that? How does that work? Can women get a, you know, a word in edgewise here from the other side of the gender? How do you?
They can and they do, but you know, one of the reasons is that we've chosen to team up together and support each other and help each other through this networking and mentoring and sharing our work with each other through this group called Women in International Security. Right now, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy is a woman, Michelle Flournoy. We've had quite a few women generals now and senior women admirals rising up through the officer ranks. We see senior women in the enlisted forces now in all of the military services. So, you know, women have a voice, but we're still way, way in the minority. So, for example, the U.S. military is about 15% women. Mm. And I would say among scholars of the military, it's probably a much lower share than that, although in our own program at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, we have two women out of the entering class of 10 graduate students this year who were very interested in security studies. So it's a, you know, it's a field that's very, really a great field for women to go into, mm-hmm. and was probably at one time extremely unwelcoming. Now it's sometimes hard for women because they can feel isolated. You might be the only woman in the room mm-hmm. when you go in to advise the Secretary of Defense, or you go, you know, you might maybe the only woman testifying when you're testifying before Congress. But it's extremely gratifying, interesting area, just, you know, and an area where so much is still not understood. Mm-hmm. There's so much work still to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cindy, thank you very much for... Wow,
oh, thank you, Arnold.
What an interesting interview. Just so much going on there. And to get some idea of what's happening behind those doors is just wonderful.
Thank you. This was such a pleasure.